Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
Remember that delicious story? I think I told it last time I was here, but it's so good, about my friend Milton Friedman, who the one who's not the economist. He was a speechwriter in the White House, this one. And one day he got a telephone call. They said, "Milton, Dr. Friedman?" He said, "Yes." And they thought it was the other Dr. Friedman. And they said, "We're a church in California, and we've got a lot of money in our treasury, and we wondered if you could suggest how we should invest it." So my friend Milton said, "Have you considered giving it to the poor?" And the guy on the other end of the phone said, "Is this the real Milton Friedman?" And Milton Friedman answered, "Yes, is this the real church?" You can't believe the conversation I had with the elders last evening. Two nights ago. I can't believe it either. They said, "We don't want you to do any religious practices in our church." I said, "I understand." I guess they meant like killing chickens or, you know, whatever you do as a Hindu, you know. So I said, "Well, I usually, after intermission, we do a meditation in which we then do, we send loving kindness thoughts to beings all over the world that are suffering. Would that be all right?" "We'd prefer you didn't." Wow. Christ sure has his work cut out for him, doesn't he? Well, he created it. Let him enjoy it. There is a certain lightness that comes with seeing that the game is only a part of the reality, seeing relative reality. Wavy Gravy, my great wise buddy in Seva, he has reminded us, he said, that if you don't have a sense of humor, it just isn't funny. When there's an accelerated period of change in the environment, those are interesting. There are optimum conditions for the bringing of the inside to the outside, of reawakening deeper truths in the culture. What can happen when things change very fast is two things happen. The people who are basically identified with their somebodyness and their stuff get frightened. Because you can't play king of the mountain when there's all that hot breath on the back of your neck. And when they get frightened, when we get frightened because of our somebodyness, we use denial or we use repression or we use anger or we use violence. But then there are those of us who have a broader context in which we understand reality. We have a deeper understanding out of which we see the reality as relatively real. And therefore, our investment isn't totally in our physical, psychological entities. That's just the incarnation. That's the part. It's the part of the dance of it all. We're not just that plane of reality. We are not just who we think we are. To the extent that you know that, I mean really intuitively know it, there is a quality of faith in you that is present. I don't mean belief in, I mean faith. You understand it, you grok it, you are one with it. that allows you to dive very deeply into your humanity and be very fully in the world without panic. In other words, there is a quality of equanimity that is present. I speak at many like benefits for peace movements, and I'm amazed at how much anger there is at those gatherings. I mean, they don't feel very peaceful to me. Now, I understand the frustration and the fear of those people. But if they get caught in their fear and frustration, what have they got to offer other human beings who are already caught in their fear and frustration, and that's why they're being unpeaceful? Where is the equanimity? The equanimity only comes out of context, out of having a context in which you see reality. Then you can see what Don Juan calls controlled folly. You and I, when you try to understand what this network is that is gathered here tonight, what we represent, is a recognition of the things you and I are talking about tonight. And that puts us in an interesting position in a period of accelerated change in society, because it puts us in the position of having we have what is needed to turn this period into an evolutionary leap rather than a revolutionary kind of paroxysm of fear. Because if people push against the inevitable, I mean, what is required now is that there are going to be changes in all of our lifestyles. I mean, you can see little ones. Like, I went down that same street in Westwood recently, or Brentwood, or wherever that was, and there were all these, out on the curbs next to the armed response signs, were all these bags with tin cans, bottles, and newspapers. That's great. I thought, far out, they sneak out at night. You know, the gate opens, probably a big hand comes out and puts it there. That's a shift in consciousness, but those are just the beginning. You've got to ask yourself now, how ready are you to dance with change? I mean, it's just an interesting moment that if you are not trapped in that which is changing, which is what Christ said, by the way. I snuck that in at the Presbyterian, at the church in Oklahoma City. He said, lay not up your treasures where moth and rust doth corrupt. And the Buddha said, everything's transitory. If you get hooked on what's transitory, you're going to suffer. So if you have acknowledged that part of your identity which isn't changing, that's interesting. It turns out to have no form to it, since all forms change. So it's nobody. Nobody doesn't change. Somebody changes. Like this past, I wore a cast for the last 6 months because I ripped my Achilles tendon. Watch the three conscious states of consciousness. I mean, I just ripped it right across. You go, oh. I did it playing tennis. Oh. In France. Oh. I love it. At any rate, I did. And, I mean, so then I had crutches, and it was like a whole new trip, you know. I mean, it quieted me down, and I got a disabled parking sticker, and it's no end of new moments. And then I took off the cast, and I got all ready to start my exercise program, and I was taking a walk, and the thing ripped again. See? I remember the moment I was crossing the street to look at an old yellow Studebaker that I saw on the other side of the street. I thought, isn't that interesting? I've never seen that model. I'll go look at it. I mean, just it was just fascination. It was so trivial what I was doing. And the light changed, and I was limping across the street because I didn't have the guts to press the button, the pedestrian button, because I'm usually the driver, and I hate people that press the pedestrian buttons because I wasn't going to be one of them. So I'm halfway across the street going to look at the Studebaker, and the light changes, and the cars, there's five lanes of cars, and I realize I'm in a peculiar position, so I hasten, and it rips. And I'm just out of the cast like a week. And I think, far out. I mean, there's another 3 months in the cast. So I decided to have an operation this time. Last time I let it heal, but I thought I'd better get on with it. So I went to the hospital, and they give you a physical exam to protect themselves from you. So I'm in an examining room naked, and this doctor walks in. How do you do? I'm Dr. So-and-so. And I, how do you do? I'm a 58-year-old Caucasian male. What do you mean by that? He said, it's obvious he doesn't want to know about my childhood trauma. I mean, he's, you know. Part of your ability to respond to change is your ability to grieve, by the way. Because when change occurs, something dies when something new happens. And the ability to, when it changes, when something dies, to feel the ripping of the loss of whatever it was, whether it was a person or a dream or a model or something. I mean, the wisdom of aging is to not deny your aging, to grieve your loss of youth, and to appreciate your aging. To finish the grieving, you don't grieve, or it's part of the whole panoply of stuff. You and I are in a moment where we're going, where what's functional now is for us to break out of the what's in it for me world and start to, like Gandhi said, when you surrender completely, you find yourself in the service of all that exists. It becomes your joy and recreation. You never tire of serving. Because when you tune in, you just become part of it all. And it's you're not doing good. You're not being righteous. You're not milking it for the melodrama. You're just part of a process. And you grieve the loss, and you open. It's interesting to examine in your own consciousness whether you anticipate change is going to be bad. I mean, most people are, to the extent you identify with your separateness, you're in a very vulnerable position because you're very little and it's very big. And you say, well, if I just keep my handkerchiefs in the drawer just that way, chaos won't rule. You know? And everybody's got their little compulsive stuff, you know, to keep it all together, you know. And then it hits the fan a little bit. You know? And I was in the earthquake out in San Francisco. And I was lying on my bed, and suddenly the doors flew open and pictures fell off the walls and a house was twisting. Wow, whew, yeah. I mean, it was like a big acid trip. I don't know if... if the house had fallen in a hole, I might have gone, oof, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what my my price is, but... I mean, there were people in the marina, for example, you know, people with nice, fancy houses, suddenly cordoned off. You can't go in there because the structure is unsound. But my credit cards are in there. Well, and there they were in the high school gymnasium having soup out of a plastic cup. That's called traumatic change. I mean, that wakes you up to who you are again, because you got in a rut. See, I mean, an earthquake is really de-rutting. Intelligent cultures have rites of passage. See, like there'd be, we go into somebody training, we know all those rites of passage. But then when you start the nobody training, which comes after the somebody training, see, and you got to become somebody before you can become nobody, by the way. That's why drugs for kids aren't so cool, because they screw around with nobodiness too soon and then they don't know where they are. Because you got to have a somebodiness to come back to, even as a hype, I mean. And then you'd have an initiation rite, like in the tribes where they take a child, like a male child is with his mother till he's seven, and then the men come and they rip him away and they take him off and they live in a man world for a year, and then he come back and he's a male in the society. Ours is more hit or miss. Makes it more interesting. But we don't have rites of passage. We don't have it institutionalized for the kind of changes we're talking about now. And maybe it only can come through trauma. President Havel said in his speech to the Joint Houses of Congress, without a global revolution in the field of human consciousness, nothing will change for the better. And they asked for his autograph, all the congressmen. That's far out. You and I are in a period in which there is a very profound change going on. It's a change about reality, it's a change about intuition, it's a change about connectedness, because the myths are dysfunctional and there are new myths emerging. And what happens, what are you an instrument of during that process? If you are rooted in that part of you, or acknowledging that part of you that isn't part of the passing show, you can enjoy the passing show, the delight, the dance, the play. You can be part of it. You can feel the pain of it because you have a context that allows you to let your human heart break again and again, because there's a deeper part of the love which isn't affected by the broken heart. I do a lot of, I spend a lot of time in one way or another with PWAs, persons with AIDS, or other people that work with people with AIDS. And a lot of the people I spend time with are not just HIV positive, which that can go anyway as I can see it, I mean, at this point. These are people who are very symptomatic and usually are very close to dropping their bodies. And this is like a leading edge for me. Let me show you what I mean by leading edge. Because here is a person who is probably young, in the sense of the expected life expectancy for a man or a woman. Perhaps that person's dreams have been shattered. So there is deep grief, expressed or not. The person is, a part of the society is socially ostracizing that person, because of the illness and how they must have gotten it. And the society isn't supporting them in the style which they would had they had a more socially acceptable disease. And they have an opportunistic illness in which you just get over one symptom and you start to feel better and you think you beat the system and you get hit with another symptom. Now, some people, I'm not talking about ARC or early or HIV positive, as I say, because that can go in any direction. But when a person is really heavy symptom, they keep getting hit. And as they get hit again and again, and all these forces of the shattered dreams, the youth, the anger, the social ostracism, the complexity of stuff with family and all of that, as they go through this process, their will often gives up. They give up. Sometimes when they just can't have the power to even lift their arm anymore. That's a very, very interesting moment. It's like, for me often, it's like watching an egg crack. And if I am quiet enough in my being and non-reactive enough, in other words, if I'm not so lost in my human pain about the reality of humanity of what this person's going through, their fear and their pain and so on, if I'm not so busy being reactive to that, and I have a little space around it, there is a moment when there's something that breaks open, and if you're right there, sometimes they're right there behind the drama. Like a quote from a nurse that once said she had extremely, he was very close to death about in cancer. And she said, yes, I know I'm dying of cancer, but look at the beauty of the universe. Is at that moment a person can come right out and suddenly, like, who's dying of AIDS? But for that to happen, my mind has to be, for me to be an environment to be ready to acknowledge that person's moment of coming up for air, if that is the way it can be, and that's their karmic predicament. My mind has to be so quiet, so free of grabbing, so free of busy being somebody doing something for somebody. If I'm too busy being nice guy hanging out with AIDS patient, then when they're not the AIDS patient, I'm stuck with my, I'm the only one in that room. What I can offer that person is two things, that my mind can be quiet enough so I am a spacious environment in which they can become what they need to be, because I can't live their death, they've got to live their death. That's their karmic, that's their opportunity, it's what they've got to do, their stuff. But I can be an environment of quietness. The other thing, and this is my leading edge, the other thing is the quality of healing for both of us that occurs when I no longer see them as separate. That is when I fall in love with them. Fall into love with them. Open my heart. Acknowledge this person as a fellow being, just like me. And to do that means that all my humanity is going to be engaged, and that includes my emotional heart, and my emotional heart, I know, is going to hurt like hell, because I'm then going to be wanting to hold on to that person as my relational heart demands, and then I'm going to grieve when they go. What pain. So I'm sitting there in the situation, realizing that no matter how spacious my mind, if my heart isn't open, if I am not in love with this person, neither of us can get fed, neither of us can get healed through this interaction. And yet, if I do open my heart, I am going to have all the pain of loss again, and I'm going to have grief, and I'm going to have it all. And the edge is right there of finally just loving somebody. And know that your heart's going to break again and again and again and again. And here we are. Our joy cannot be rooted in the denial of suffering. Our joy has to be rooted in being fully with what is. This process of change on ourselves, or acknowledging how we respond to change so that we can stay open under changing conditions and bring to the culture what it needs to allow it to move in an evolutionary leap at this point through the fact that we, with our lives as our message, come forth to make the inner world consonant with the outer world. So we work to create social institutions like we've done with Seva. Social institutions that represent the inner heart, that represent truth and compassion and impeccability and stuff like that. And we need not fear fulfilling our incarnations as political entities, as family entities, because there is where our feeding comes. We learn how to use life as food through which we become healed. And the whole phrase, it's too much, turns into, it's just enough. Ah, yeah. Wow. Whew. There goes the house. Ooh. Yeah. For you and I to acknowledge what we are together, this networking process, why we come together like this, is for this purpose, to find strength in the realization that there are other people that are sharing this understanding of the earth and the world and the way we are and who we are and who we aren't. The Dalai Lama said, he's really, by the way, he's really good. He's really very cool cat. The Dalai Lama said, meet everybody as if you already know them. Which I think he cleaned up for Western consumption. Because the Eastern version, as I've heard, is meet everybody as your mother. But I don't think he figured we were ready for that yet. Because he means in a reincarnational sense that we were, see. But it's, I mean, everybody here you already know. Hi! I haven't seen you this entire incarnation. Where have you been keeping yourself? You rascal. I mean, this is the living room. This is the family. What are we going to do? We're all in the stew together. People say, well, is it hopeless? Got a great line from somebody, T.S. Eliot. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope of the wrong thing. I mean, whatever it is, it's going to be much farther out than you can think. The thinking mind is so trivial the way it creates projections. How it is so much more interesting. I mean, all the things I was figuring out when I was in college about what I'd be when I grow up, none of them were like this. I think it's a very interesting exercise for us to listen to and examine our lives to see how we respond to change and to consider the possibility that you could open to change and realize that it's a curriculum and an adventure, and and out of it may come something, probably will come more than you thought would come, even when it's scary. People that have changes happening in their bodies, in their economics, in their political life, in their family life. At what point are you conscious enough to entertain, along with the feeling of, oh God, am I suffering, the possibility that suffering is grace? To keep that balance, I won't ask for it, but if it comes, wow, this is far out. And the deepest fear, of course, is the one of death. That's the one the mind is most freaked about. And to have the lightness, the if you don't have a sense of humor, it isn't funny place. It's like the Zen monk who's dying and his students say, but you haven't written your death poem, Master. And he sits up and I haven't written my death poem. And he picks up his brush and he calligraphies madly and then dies. And the calligraphy says, birth is thus, death is thus, verse or no verse, what's the fuss? If you'd find a way to be comfortable and quiet, just start to experience just what is. Just being with the sounds and the feelings. The sensations. Not pushing anything or pulling anything, just allowing. Feel a seat under you and the floor under your feet. And the sounds. And the air against your skin. And feel the presence of all of us as a shared consciousness. And bring your awareness to your breath. Just allowing it to naturally move in your body. Your breath along with your thoughts and sensations. And then imagine the breath moving in and out of the middle of the chest. And just using your imagination, imagine that what you're drawing in when you breathe into your chest is some healing quality, some substance, whether it's made of light or soma or elixir or whatever. You're just drawing it in through the middle of your chest and let it go into the head, the arms, and the torso, and the legs, just as like a healing balm that flows into the body. And then on the out-breath, whatever tension or fear or stuff that just seems to get loosened by that stuff you just breathed in, just let it pour out through the chest and then draw in again that quality of healing light. And do that a few times. And after you have been able to let go of whatever it is that you can let go of at this point, start to change it so that what you breathe in and what you breathe out through the middle of your chest is the same thing. There's a quality that you breathe in from the universe of healing, light, and presence, and love, and quietness, and sweetness. And there's a quality you breathe out of your heart that you send in all directions of the same thing. You become like a conduit or a beacon or a lighthouse or a... C.S. Lewis says, you don't see the center because it's all center. Your heart is the center of the entire universe. Each heart is the center. So now imagine around you, in all directions, in concentric circles, as far as the mind can imagine. Just imagine all beings, all human beings, all beings of all species, all beings in all forms, all beings of past, all beings of future, all beings on this plane and all other planes. Just as far as the mind can imagine, beings. And in many of these beings, the karma of their beingness, there is some suffering. And so from that place in the middle of your chest, as you breathe in and out, send out from the middle of your being in all directions a quality of healing light, just touching each person, each being, each thing. There is a meditation of loving kindness. We'll use four lines of it. I'll say the line, and then if it feels good in your heart, we'll repeat it together. The last line is long, so I'll break it into segments. This is a way to guide the heart as it is surrounded by all beings everywhere. May all beings everywhere be free from danger. May all beings everywhere be free from danger. May all beings everywhere be free from mental suffering. May all beings everywhere be free from mental suffering. May all beings everywhere be free from physical suffering. May all beings everywhere be free from physical suffering. May all beings everywhere be enabled. May all beings everywhere be enabled to carry out their lives, to carry out their lives in peace and happiness. For you to be that pure instrument, you finally must be free yourself from suffering. So just once more, for ourselves. May I be free from danger. May I be free from mental suffering. May I be free from physical suffering. May I be enabled to carry out my life in peace and happiness. May I be enabled to carry out my life in peace and happiness.
Once, upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this, and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here, forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more." Presently, my soul grew stronger. Hesitating then no longer, sir, said I, "or madam, truly, your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is, I was napping. And so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here, I opened wide the door. Darkness there. Nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering. Long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before, but silence was unbroken. The stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this, nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning, soon again I heard a tapping, somewhat louder than before. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. But my heart is still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more. Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door, perched and sat, nothing more. Then, this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling, by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore, though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou, I said, art sure not craven, ghastly, grim, and ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore, quoth the raven. Nevermore. Much I marvel this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore, for we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast, upon the sculpted bust, upon his chamber door, with such a name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on the pallid bust, spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing farther than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before. On the morrow, he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before. Then, the bird said, nevermore. Startled by the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, doubtless, said I, what it utters is its only stock in store, caught from some unhappy master whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore. But the raven. Still beguiling all my fancy into smiling straight, I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then, upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er she shall press on evermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer swung by seraphim, whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee respite. Respite and nepenthe from the memories of Lenore. Quaff, O quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore, quoth the raven. Nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still of bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate, yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me, truly I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore, quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still of bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Clasp a rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, quoth the raven. Nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked upstarting, get thee back into the tempests and the night's plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken, quit the bust above my door, take thy beak from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door, quoth the raven. Nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting, on the pallid bust of palace just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor, and my soul, from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor, shall be lifted.
Father died. We left him a little farm in New England. All the long black funeral cars left the scene, and the boys just standing there alone, looking at the shiny red tractor. Him and his daddy used to sit inside and circle the blue fields and grease the night. It was as if someone had spread butter on all the fine points of the stars, cause when he looked up they started to slip. And he put his head in the crooks of his arms and he started to drift, 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 have a ship, let the ship slide. Thank you. His face lit up with such naked joy that the sun burned around his lids, and his eyes were like two suns. White lids, white opal, seeing everything just a little bit too clearly. And he looked around and there was no black ship in sight, no black funeral cars, nothing except for him. The raven fell on his knees, looked up and cried out, "No!
Yeah.
the tiles. The sun had melted the sand and it coagulated like a river of glass. When it hardened, he looked at the surface. He saw his face, and where their eyes were just two white opals. Two white opals, where there were eyes, there were just two white opals. And he looked up, and the rays shot, and he saw Raven coming in. And he crawled on his back, and he went up.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.